Okay, so I think at this point, Professor Saemin really needs little to no introduction. So I think I'm done. But we just want to really welcome everyone. This is our second annual Tikkun El Hoshana Rabbah, and I think it's a great tradition that we've started, and there's really no one better to continue that than the opportunity to learn with clients. So thank you everyone for coming and passing the baton.
Thank you. So the truth is, this is going to be a little different than what I usually do, which is to focus on like one text or one Gemara and try to like pick it apart, and really just go through this question of etrogim and the esrog business and how that comes up in the halachic literature, and take this opportunity to look at some, I would say, choshen mishpat doctrines, some more familiar, some less familiar, but sort of how they play out in practice. And we'll see, again, some I think will be more familiar, some less familiar. And what's going to tie together is this question of etrogim, but we're going to look at it from a bunch of different perspectives. This is a sugya that really doesn't, it's not a sugya in the Gemara, not really even, not in the Rishonim. Really, it's not until the 19th century that people start talking about this question, and we'll see it from a couple of different ways. We'll start with what I would call the local price question, in other words, an individual transaction, and then look a little bit at some of the more global questions about how halachic standards and prices might interact in a variety of different ways. So let's just first cover some basics. There's three halachic doctrines that we need to think about. The first is called ona'a. Ona'a, I think the best translation for this in English is called price fraud. And the basic story of ona'a is that if you charge more than one... That looks scary. If you charge more than one-sixth above the accepted market price, so then it's kana, meaning I've acquired it, but the seller, it depends, it could be the seller, the buyer has to return that overcharge. So kana umachzir ona. If it's beyond 1/6, so then it's what's called bitul mekach. In other words, we rewind the whole transaction. And title doesn't transfer. In other words, I don't get the property like that. Now, there's really nothing like this in American law. The closest, I have my former contract student here, is unconscionability. In its heyday, there was some sense of something like price unconscionability. But basically, this is a non-existent doctrine in American law. American law is much more sort of, you bought it, those are the terms, unless there's some specific state statute to the contrary. And we'll see in general, halacha is more interested in what I would call, what scholars anyway call, transactional justice. In other words, is this a fair bargain? Than in the formalities of, was there offer and acceptance? Did each side agree? So that is one idea. Now, you can, in general, we say you cannot contract out of ona. If you make a t'nai, say, I'm kona this, I'm menacha, ain't lo ona, that doesn't count. Unless you say, there is X amount of ona in this, the real price is X, but I'm charging you Y, then it probably works. One of the hard questions, whether we think about it from the Gemara's angle or from our own angle, is what is the baseline price? In other words, the Gemara sort of takes it, it's a little bit hard to imagine exactly what reality they're talking about. But it was like the question of establishing the prices for the Gemara, not a complicated one at all. It's sort of just given that there's prices for things, everybody knows them. And then the question is, you know, what happens after that? As we'll see, as we get to the sort of more modern reality, there's going to be a lot of question of, well, what is the price for something? And that's going to come up having to do with etrogim. So I think, like, for our perspective, the hard question, particularly if you think about it in the modern context, is what is the price from which you begin to sort of think about 1/6 more, 1/6 or what? Yeah, that's one idea. The other doctrine is a mekach ta'ut, which is related, but this is basically, there's a fundamental flaw in the transaction. In other words, there's not an agreement on what is being bought and sold. And we'll see where that comes up. In our sugya, it's actually going to be the starting point. And there's a discussion shown on whether title transfers in the case where there's mekach ta'ut. So the classic example is, I think you're selling me, you know, an apple, and you sell me a pear, mekach ta'ut. There's no contract. A third idea is what's called mum b'mekach. And this is, if we sort of know the American law idea of caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. In other words, once you take something, particularly if you had a chance to look at it, any defects, any problems with it is really on the buyer. Halacha basically has the opposite presumption, or a much stronger understanding that, no, the seller is actually on the hook for all sorts of defects, whether they're latent, whether they're obvious, and this is called mum b'mekach. And typically, a buyer can rely on a warranty expressly made. That's true in American law, too. But halacha is much more, as compared to American law, much more in favor of finding implied warranties. That you didn't say it, but this is what people understand, or this is how people assume, or this is what usually happens. Things that in American law you're going to be, it's not a good idea. If I'm advising clients, not a good idea to rely on those. You typically want a very express warranty. Halacha is much... much more forgiving of, or much more likely to rewind a transaction for that basis. A sort of wrinkle that is a little bit relevant to us is that, we'll call it ritual status, is considered a mum b'mekach. So the case that comes up is that if I sell you a behemah, and you're shochetin in its treif, right? So then that is called mum b'mekach, because... right, it's not, so even if it's a perfectly otherwise fine cow, that's a mum, right? If I sell you a suit and it has shatnez, right, you can imagine I sell you fruit, it has orla, right, all those sorts of things, those are all mumim b'mekach. For our purposes, if I sell you an esrog and it's not kosher, right, you can't be yotz in it, that's also a mum b'mekach. More complicated is what if it's, let's say, you're yotz deraisa but not derabana. Or it's an esrog, but it's not mehudar, or things like that. And we might see some examples of that. Okay, so that's going to be our basic sort of overview of the relevant choshen mishpat concepts that are going to be present here.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I'm just a little confused. So you're saying that if someone sells something and it's not exactly what they said it would be, the onus is on the seller.
That's right.
And the implied value or whatever...
Right. So if I, under American law or halacha, if I tell you this is an apple,
right,
and it's a pear, that's no good. Mm-hmm. The difference is going to be, is like, you know, what if, I mean, there's a lot of cases, but in terms of implied things, in other words, I didn't say anything, but like, if I sell you an esrog, sort of, can you assume it's kosher or not? Where does the burden...
But you're saying the burden's more on the seller.
The burden is more on the seller in halacha.
Yes. Assumed that this was whatever.
Who has to sort of bear the costs of if things mm-hmm. are... Exactly. Okay, so why does this come up in the etrog business? So there's a couple of reasons why this happens. Largely historical and one halachic. So basically in the last 300 or 400 years, application of choshen mishpat, which is the sort of civil law part of halacha, has generally been retrenching. In cases that are sort of what I would call purely commercial with no ritual elements to them. That's obviously a broad statement, and we could give a whole series of shiurim on that, but as a kind of basic trend, what you see is where choshen mishpat gets applied in the intersections of other areas of halacha and choshen mishpat. So, for example, if you look at the Beit Din's docket, it's going to be lots of rabbi shul contracts, and much fewer, you know, sellers of oranges and buyers of peaches contracts. You know, building a shul, building a mikvah, right, this sort of stuff happens all the time. These other things, less so. Yerusha is another one. Things that relate to property division after divorce. So the areas of choshen mishpat that tend to get a lot of play are those that there's a reason that the we'll call it the rabbinic system is sort of already engaged in. And esrogim are an obvious example of that. Otherwise, market customs tend to prevail, and people take this in other places. Another reason is that, as you probably know, on the first day of Sukkot in particular, you have to own the esrog mideoraisa. Now, so there's a whole body of law called kinyanim, sort of how you acquire something. In general, halacha is pretty lax about this in the following sense. There are formal Torah ways, called kinyanim mideoraita, to acquire something, but then there's all sorts of commercial practices and commercial customs. And the halacha is usually, you know, pretty comfortable with the fact that, so the classic example is the handshake. The handshake is not mentioned in the Gemara or the Rishonim, right, but eventually it becomes the sort of way it happens. And then the poskim say that's fine, because there's an idea in Gemara called Situnta, or Minag HaSochrim, the custom of the merchants. However, there's some places where we say, no, because there is a mitzvah d'oraita at play here. Maybe you need a kinyan d'oraita. And this is basically three places. Things having to do with kiddushin, right? Again, you have to buy, right, because there's a sort of non-civil law matter there. Mechiras chametz is where it shows up a lot. Again, because you're doing a sale, it's more of a ritual sale than a commercial sale. And the acquisition of the Dalad Minim or the Esrog on the first day of Sukkot because you need lachem. So now there's going to be a little more attention being paid to this question of the kinyan. Two sort of reasons that are slightly less important but sort of play in the background is that there is the source or one of the sources for the idea of the hamitzvah baba avera, in other words, that you can't do a mitzvah if sort of it's too connected to the avera. The classic example is the first line in the third parak of Sukkah lulav hagazel, right? The stealing of the lulav. Right, so that's a classic name. You can't steal lulav and be yotze with it. So because of that sort of the sort of home base of a sugi of mitzvah baba avera, making sure you actually own the dalad minim is in dalad minim, though it applies all over. There's a sort of extra concern here and again, and then the idea sort of related of hadar, right? That particularly for the asrog, maybe for all the dalad minim, there's an idea this should be done in a sort of, you know, a super A-plus manner, right? And therefore, again, that's why these questions show up here. So again, those are the four reasons that why in Esrogim we're going to see some more action surrounding some of these Chosh and Mishpah concepts that don't play out equally or the same way in other places. Okay, just one more sort of intro, a little bit about the Esrog market. The Esrog market's actually a very funny kind of market, right? It's not like anything else, because on the one hand, it's a fruit. But it's really nothing like the fruit market, because what do people use Esrogs for? So there's basically two answers. Sukkahs.
Right.
Jam.
Throw a mitzvah on it.
What? The court? No, man. But so the problem, if you cut open the esrog, right, as my kids are, you know, there's a ton of peel and like very little fruit, right? So it's not particularly useful. So it's not, right, it's not good for anything. They use it sometimes for perfumes, right, because it does smell very good. But basically, right, the vast majority of esrog grown have basically one day's worth of usage. So if we think of the economics a little bit, right, the day after Sukkot, nobody buys esrogim, right? Certainly, you know, by Hoshana Rabba evening, an esrog is basically worthless. So in terms of the price, right, if we think about why does it cost so much, I think there's a bunch of reasons. But one of them, right, this is a very bizarre economic model, right, that you have to grow all of these. Right, whatever you sell Erev Sukkot, and after that, they're essentially worthless. So think in terms of the opportunity costs and the acreage and has to be dedicated to these things. There's some problems in it. Right, it's also right. Then the other issue is that in other words, in terms of the pricing, right? How are these priced exactly? So in this sense, it's a little bit like artwork, right? Because in other words, there's a sense at which each one is sort of individually judged, but there's not 100% agreement on what precisely the qualities ought to be, and different people value different things, right? So, and then of course the time sensitivity that we talked about. Sort of other issues have to do with grafting, right? So there's this idea that you need an esrog, you know, whatever the halachic definition of esrog is, and not something that was grafted or genetically engineered or something like that. So there's some anxiety over which sort of classes of esrogim or which lines of esrogim are right. So basically, I think largely that accounts for the cost, because certainly no other grown product works in this. And I'm sure some economists can come up with other examples of markets like this that have, you know, basically a no demand, a huge spike, and then a huge fall right afterwards. Here we go. I was saying, I wonder if Ronell is here. And here you are. So what concert tickets?
Yeah, I guess that's very similar as well. Like the band, like, it's not identical, but the you know, the minute the concert is over, right?
Right, but the ticket's not a thing. I mean, no value went into producing that thing, right?
So, right,
but
they
what?
It's a Halloween pumpkin. But you don't need, but it's not the same type of investment where you need land and you need all those pieces.
Well, you know, you need like the sand and
okay, so but so whatever. So it has this feature, and I'm sure you could model it for us, and all sorts of things I want to understand.
I say that not just suggest, but then, I mean, there's not enough today, but he, you know, becomes the thought about how to price this kind of thing.
Okay. Okay, so that's our background. So now let's look at two simanim, or two seifim, sorry, one siman Shulchan Aruch, that are going to be, to the extent this is like a home base for this sugya, it's the following. So this is in Choshen Mishpat, siman Reish Tet. So this is in sort of the laws of Mekach Umemkar. And the Mechaber writes as follows. Hamakna l'chaveiro davar she'enu misuyim. If someone sells somebody something that is not specific, and I'll say exactly what that means in a second. Im haya mino yadua, afal pi she'en midato mishkavo yadua. If you know what you're buying, so you're buying apples, even if you don't know how many or what weight, harezekana, then that's a valid kinyan. Im ein mino yadua, but if you don't know what it is that you're buying, lo kana. Okay, so Ketzad, what's the example? Arima shel chitin ani mocher lach bekach vekach. Martef shel yain ani mocher lach bekach vekach. Sak shel te'enim ani mocher lach bekach vekach. So if I'm selling you a pile of grain, or a cellar of wine, or a sack full of figs, in so and such price, afal pi she'en midat arima yadua, even if I don't know how many things are in this pile, v'lo minyan ha-kankanim, v'lo mishkal te'enim, the number of bottles, or the number of figs, or the weight of the figs, I raise them in korakayam. Afal pishanim sachaser yoter ala omen sheabedatam. It is a valid sale, even if it turns out that there's more or less from the sort of guesstimate that the parties had. V'yesh lahem ona l'fi shar shebashuk. We'll come back to that line, but there is a claim for ona'a based on what the price is at market. However, sif bet aval amar l'chaviru. Everything in this house, whatever thing I sell you and such. Anything in this box.
Not
what?
Let's make a deal
with
it.
Right, exactly. Obisak, or in this bag. Ani mocher lach b'kach b'kach. V'ratza lokeach u'mashach. And they agree, and he sort of makes a sort of formal act on it, acquisition on it. Ain katan kinyan. There is no valid kinyan shelo sam chadato shelokeach, because the buyer did not really agree or cannot agree. Shere inu dem ayeshbo im teben o zahav, because there's no idea if he's buying straw or gold. The ain zelak imasachik kubia, and it's just like he's gambling. Right, that line is complicated. V'chein kol kayotze b'zeh. Okay, so you see this. What do we buy in boxes? Esras. Okay, so this is going to be... Okay, so the rest of this sounds like stuff that only idiots do, right? Buying things, right? Like law school hypotheticals. Except, wait a minute, everybody buys a box, an esrog in a box. Now we'll see there's different types of boxes, and maybe that's part of the story here. But at least you see now why this became the
you know what you're buying.
Well, that's going to be the... I'm sorry? Okay, so alright. So
John. Sachel to Adium. Sachel to Grace. What's the difference to the box of the SRS?
Okay, so we're going to see. This is going to cause.
Say, you don't know.
Alright, so this is going to be the. You're already. Right, so I guess the question asked this way: is buying an esrog more like Simon Aleph, Sif Aleph, or Sif Beis? So, Sif Aleph. Okay, but let's start with somebody who says, not like Josh. But I'm just trying to say that this is why the discussion enters here, because like, actually you do buy things in boxes that you don't know what's going on.
The whole question for me is looking down because the rest of this is an announcement.
Right, so, all right, so...
I mean, I think you have other complaints on sellers from the box. I don't know if it begins here. Meaning, as you pointed out, there are like three or four things. Right? So...
I think factual matter, this is where most of the discussion
is.
Right,
it's just interesting that
Now, maybe it's path dependent. I mean, the first who did it was a Chachma Shlomo. We'll see him later. But I think just the fact of like Teva, box, it kind of like got people's ears perked. Okay, so.
But again, it's like a Komash Teva. But you No, right, as opposed to...
Okay, but now the question is, it sort of gets it, because an esrog, in other words, if it's not kosher, it's not...
Right, no,
it's not an esrog.
Right,
so, okay, now we're getting into the... Right, let's get there. Okay, so the first sort of... it's not the first to talk about. I mean, again, now,
well, so when, here it sounds like in Sif Aleph that there's a fixed price, and it's just the quantity that's unknown, right?
Correct.
And not so it sounds.
What are we in quality?
The quantity.
And quality.
Like both, or potentially.
Yeah, it sounds more like he would seem to be focusing more on the mechaber.
In midas,
yeah.
Minyan and kind of a mishkan.
All right. Anyway, so that. Anyway, that. So if I were to think, that's not exactly like the case of the Ed. That seems like a significant difference.
All right. So let's sort of go through it, because all these opinions are out there. Mm-hmm. But let's start with the Shas. Okay. So all these discussions. I mean, basically everyone in our discussion here lived in the 19th century in Eastern Europe. So I don't know like who published first what, but there's all basically around the same time, because presumably at this time they start selling esrogim in boxes. What?
Some of us think that only that's the only time in Jewish history that exists.
The second century and the 19th.
No, but what? But the boxes, we can open our box. So
okay, so that'll be part of the discussion.
Right.
So you're right. Meaning there's a question of, in other words, well, let's just lay it out. But you can think of boxes in the fry rates. You can think of you're a kind of wholesaler. You buy a crate full of esrogim. You could think of the way the boxes used to work, where you just bought an unopened box, in other words, and they wouldn't let you open it, or if they want to open it, you had to pay more. You can have a box that makes a representation, etrog mehudar, or something like that, or you can have a box whose price makes an implicit representation, right? This is an $80 esrog, or a $60 esrog, or a $20 esrog, or a $200 esrog. Right? Those are going to be the kind of cases we'll play with. Okay, so the Shas and Tshuva Shem Arya, who is a Leib Arya of Bolacho, or Bolachov is probably the better way to say it. Basically, he makes the claim, and we'll read some of it inside, maybe not all of it, that, no, really, this is exactly the problem in Seif Bet. In other words, not Seif Aleph, or not neither, but that, you know what the problem is? And this is basically right now. You see why it's a big issue, because if it's bitul mekach, if it's mekach or bitul mekach, or there's no kinyan, then you don't own it. If you don't own it, you're not yotze, right? So this is a very serious issue for him. So he says, "Bezot Hashanah, santi libi kodem chag haSukkot binyan etrogim, asher asuchim avilim meir leir lemochram." So I started paying attention to the etrog trade. "V'hine derech mikzatam limkor argal shalem kmosha," and it's the practice to sell a box as it is. Sometimes they sell them open, meaning you can inspect them, sometimes closed, and sometimes you have no idea what you're buying. Now, sometimes you have etrogim that are worth a lot of money, and some are very bad, you can't even make a bracha on them. Shatrog shehu mekabel hu yafeh kama dinar izav. Lomim yalla biyado cheres etrog sheinu shaveklum. Pashet inyan mechira zot kol mekamot ze miyamim b'shanot rabot. So he's describing the ways it works, right? So sometimes you can wind up with etrogim that are worth a lot of money. Sometimes they're not worth anything. Because again, this is the problem. Does that worry the bracha? There's no other value to an etrog. And then he asks, basically, how does this work? V'ala libi safek. That's the problem. So he says this is basically like, you know, in the full thing he kind of goes through a whole analysis of Seif Bet. He says, so this is just like this thing that you're basically buying what's in a box that you have no idea, because it could be worth tons of money or it could be worth nothing. And I think his point would be, right, that this is where the halachic element comes up, because chitin that are of lower quality are still chitin. But an esrog that's not roi lebracha, I mean, you could get all lumnishin whether it's a din esrog or not, but basically it's worth, it has like no value, and that's not something that
is that really what he's saying?
it's you're saying like maybe it's a pusillectric. So
well, that's one possible outcome, right?
No. But that didn't seem to be what he was focusing on. It seemed more on the random aspect.
That's right, but the random in others.
No. It could be that I'm expecting a certain quality, and there could be variation on that quality, and that could create the Masachek Kuvia. Right.
So it's
that
not.
That seems more extreme.
I think it works well with.
I'm going on the
walk. Right.
Why is that just a
Mekach Telos?
I
sell
selling
the
restaurant,
but
it's just an adventure.
No, I'm agreeing that it could be
if the seller and the seller has a beautiful aspect, so he
right, of course it goes.
Then you could, for example, say, well,
he would regret it.
Right, it goes both ways.
It's not a mechanism because they both know up front that it might be anything from puzzle to very nice, and they say that's fine, that's why we're charging only $20 instead of $50. And even so, that's Masafek Bekubi. That's not a good kid.
Is that what you say, that the seller doesn't know what it would be?
He doesn't.
Okay,
reception. Right, and he really says that...
doesn't this work?
Ava be'etrog se'asafek hu, this is not a thing, beguf ha'davar ve'hu kekone suma ba'aruba im tov ve'im ra, lo samcha da'i teklal. In other words, he says that because... What?
Well, that's Masafek.
It's an asmach. Okay, so that gets into that whole story. And therefore, basically... Yeah. He says that you shouldn't do it this way, right? Lachain shomer nafsho yirchak mizeh v'yikne etros yafe v'hadar ma she'enav wrote b'kesef malek asher chananu to Hashem v'chacham lev yikach mitzvos mitzvah bar miras enayim tzichlius b'li shum pikbuk. Okay, umiyom she'amadati al dati lo kaniti etros satum minhai. So therefore he says no good because it's a mesafek b'kubia, or it fits into the siman bet, and therefore, whether it's mekach tot or... Okay, but that's essentially his view. I think the points that have been raised, have been raised by others, and I think are about right. And just one more thing he adds that... he has some other... Okay, let's just leave it there. Okay, so sort of one view is you can't do this, because you're not going to have a kinyan.
Can you, in this case, can you open it?
So, what exactly is his solution?
His solution is not to buy from the closed
box.
It
sounds like he couldn't open it.
Right. So,
that's pretty substantial.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Full disclosure of what you're getting. Full disclosure of what you're getting. Okay. So, I didn't have this, I couldn't find it online. Now, a second issue is, okay, let's say you disagree with this analysis and you think it's more like the case in Seif Aleph. In other words, it's not Bitul Mekach, but it's the case where you sort of know enough about what you're buying that you're a Kona. However, the Beit Yitzchak, who is Rav Yitzchak Shmalkus, who again lives in Galatia basically in the 19th century, he says, okay... he's not responding to the Shemariah, but sort of comes as this. And he thinks, no, this is clearly a Seif Aleph case. But he says, what about the Ona? Right? Because that last line that's underlined, it says, V'yeshlem Ona l'fi shar shebashuk. So what happens if you buy, it could go either way, right? Either a really...
Does he agree even if the Esther is possible?
No, he's talking about when the Esther is kosher.
Kosher, but the value is...
Exactly. That's his case. And he says, I've never seen anybody who... I've never seen the seller give back money to a buyer, who buys an esrog for too much money because the esrog he got is of lower quality.
You may have explained this before, but in the case of onah, it's a valid sale, but there's an obligation on the seller to
exactly. That's right. So he's not concerned about the kinyan element. But he is concerned. He says, and I think it's worthwhile, right? Even if you're in Seif Aleph, you still have the Ona problem. And he says, I've never seen anybody deal with this. And therefore, he says that the truth is that there's a, and maybe we'll introduce here the concept of Kimle, which is a kind of a little bit of a nutty concept, but is also sort of relevant to this. So Kimlei in Choshen Mishpat is the idea that, well, just like in Orach Chaim, you could say, I hold of this Shita, I hold of this Rav, right? And then you're entitled to that position. Now, in Choshen Mishpat, it goes like this. Suppose that there's a machlokas, let's say, achronim, between, I don't know, the Ksos and the Nesivos on a certain issue. And it turns out that if the Ksos is right, I win, and if the Nesivos is right, Rabbi Sinensky wins. I can say, but I hold like the Ksos. Right? And you're allowed to be somewhat instrumentalist about this. And the theory is, well, it's Hamotzi Mechavero Olav Haraya, right? Because the plaintiff bears the burden of proof, then the plaintiff has to prove, right, that the halacha is not like the Ksos. And since the plaintiff can't prove that the halacha is not like the Ksos, so then the muchzak, in other words, the defendant, is allowed to say, I hold like the Ksos, and therefore the plaintiff cannot win. Now, there's been more recently a lot of writing on this, right, because as I always say, the idea of Kimlei and the Bar-Ilan CD basically gets you the regime that plaintiff always wins, right? Because you could always find something. It's not that hard. So there's been attempts to kind of to narrow it, but that's the basic idea. I don't know how well known it is outside of people who read the Choshen Mishpat, but it's sort of worth knowing that such a concept exists. And therefore, he says like this. So that line that we said, Yesh Bo Ona, that's actually a little more complicated. And it seems to be subject to a machlokas in the Rishonim, or maybe the Beit Yosef and everybody else, basically, as to when. And this gets into what is the price from which we're calculating a sixth more of? And when does that apply? And the way that Beit Yosef understands this is he says, okay, that when we say your machzer ona'a is, right, when the price is known. But when the price is not known, then it's not subject to onah. And the Beis Yosef says, and even though most people disagree with the Beis Yosef, the reason that no one has to be machzer onah is because the sellers, the Esrog sellers, are implicitly saying, Kimlei keha Beis Yosef, I hold like the Beis Yosef. And since the price of Esrogs is volatile and nobody knows what they're worth, therefore there's no way to get onah on it.
Well, but you could
many have challenged this.
You could also say something like, well, you know, someone buys an Esrog and they claim that it's a puzzle, right? You could say, well, I hold like so-and-so that says it's not a puzzle.
Right.
So that's
another variation of this.
Yeah.
That's right. And there's a whole discussion of whose stock you have to follow there. Let's just sort of leave that for a second.
Right.
Does
it help to sign a contract before you actually buy it?
Probably. Probably, right. So that you don't hold of Kimlei, and a lot of Beis Dins today, when you sign the Shtar Bararus, will say, we're not playing with the Kimlei rules. Okay, let's leave that for a second. He brings a proof from a famous tshuva of the Rush. And the Rush is dealing with a case where someone is buying the right to collect taxes. Okay, so the way it worked, it seems to be a tax on wine and meat in the community. And basically, the local governing ruler would say, we want such and such money, and you'd pay them up front, and then you'd have the right for the year to go and tax everybody who collected from it. Now, apparently, this is a case where he bought it from another Jew. He bought this right. And then it turns out that he had a very bad year, and he didn't make a lot of money on it. So he wanted to come and claim, because I paid you whatever, 10,000, and I only collected 6,000, and you see the right was only worth 6,000, and therefore there's no onah. So that's the tshuva of the Rush. So the Beit Yitzchak sort of reads that through the Beit Yosef and says same thing here. Now many, many people challenge this on the following, what lawyers would talk about the difference between, right, there's almost, right, in these cases of onah, there's almost three possibilities. That the buyer doesn't, one party doesn't know the price, both parties don't know the price, or the price is unknowable. And what the kind of pushback to the Beit Yitzchak has been, no, you're confusing two different issues. An Esrog is a case where perhaps both one or both parties don't know the price. But there, everybody understands that there's onah, you just have to figure out what the price is. You want to distinguish that from the case of the rush, where the price is unknowable, right? Nobody knows. That's the nature of this transaction. When you buy a right, right? It's basically you're buying a business, right? And nobody knows the value of the business. There's no valuation. It's inherently speculative. And that's when we mean that there's no onah. But distinguish that from the case when simply the price isn't known to the people, but with some work you can go.
Because they haven't opened the box.
No, he's talking about even if you...
He's arguing, go ahead and open the box, and then the price is normal.
No, the box is open. Right? He thinks that just escrow prices are just too all over the place, right? Because it depends on sort of... He doesn't really explain it, but he just says, ain't a shari
yadua. Because there's no... I mean, how do you make the valuation for what it's worth?
He's saying there's never any onah.
Right, because he thinks that...
Well, or there's enough variation in it.
There's enough variation.
You don't have to have like a 16% variance or whatever in it.
Right. Now, his grandson, and that's the Avnei Chefetz, has a different question, which is sort of interesting. So he's writing in World War II, and he says, here's his case. The town, there was very hard to get esrogs, and one guy came, and he basically smuggled in an esrog and sold it for, an enormous sum. And the next day, someone else showed up with the second esrog. And sold it for much cheaper. So everybody said, wait a minute. The first guy was Ma'anas. And he sort of follows in the footsteps of his grandfather and said, this is an interesting tshuva because he starts getting up to this as a corporate entity, a kubalka thing. In other words, this is the community. But basically, he says there's no onah. But I think that contrasting the... He says that too, but I think... I think contrasting
the time
these two
when it was brought,
is useful. Right. So he actually quotes this Gemara and I use this in my contracts class, this Gemara in Ksuvos, where the boat comes, the boat's held up, and there's literally an American law case, it's the exact same facts. The boat with all the wheat's going to come, it gets stuck, so people start selling their houses to kind of buy the wheat in the future, and then the boat shows up, and all of a sudden the prices fall, what do you do? There's a bunch of cases like that in this Gemara in Ksuvos as well. So he basically says there is no onah in that case because the price is known. But I think it's worth distinguishing the grandfather and the grandson. I think the grandson's right, and I think I'm less convinced that the Beis Yitzchak is right, because I think these cases are very different. The Beis Yitzchak is not talking about, he seems to be talking about open esrog. I mean, just that there's some inherent variance or uncertainty in the market as to what each one's worth. But there, I think the response of most of the Ashkenazi poskim is that, it's a little hard, but, we, in UCC land, we establish market price all the time, so you get experts to do that. As opposed to this case of in the war, where it's just an unknown market. In other words, you just have no idea. This is not a regular market. This is not a regular thing. You just have no idea how much it's worth. One guy shows up and he smuggles one in, and then the next day, but that guy, person might not come. So I think actually in that case, it's right to say that. And there, the market is not such where one can establish a baseline price where there's enough. But I would distinguish that from a case of a sort of the normal variance in the market of what is considered an onah price. All right, so that's sort of theory two. So theory one is, you're right, this is a problem from Mekach, basically Mekach Tos, from Masachet Bechubya, don't buy it. That was the Rav of Balacho. The Beis Yitzchak was, it's not that problem, but it is onah. But how come no one collects onah? Because this is not the sort of thing that one can kind of collect onah on. A third view, and this is probably historically the first person to raise this issue, is from the Chachma Shlomo, or Shlomo Kluger, in his gloss to the Shulchan Aruch, which is printed on the page. And he, again, responding to the same simon, says as follows. Source number 5. Hinei b'din akone etrogin stumim, b'nimsa mekulkalim me'od, b'hifsed akone harbe, im yeshman din ona umekach taos. So he says, basically, what happens when you buy a closed box, and they're not any good. Is there a case of onah mekam tchaus? It says, Hinei b'emet nar ha'iti b'gam zakanti v'lo ha'iti mi sheba v'tvo ha'onah v'vito mekach betrogim. So he says, listen, I've been a long around time, I've been here 37 years, and I live here in the town where it's the sort of central area for the esrog trade in his locale. And lo nishma ma'olam sheyavo echad v'yifatze pihu b'zeh. I've never seen anybody come and raise this issue. And he has a different theory. V'atam hu ki kenu ha-minag ha-tagarim shekonin adayta da'achi. The impo v'imra v'af... And the reason is because it's simply a matter of minhag, of custom. This is the custom that prevails amongst the merchants. And everybody knows that, no backsies. And therefore, that's why you don't hear any of this. But even though amat na'amashe ein lavo na, ein lavo na, hainu midina, even though it's true that if you make a t'nai, that I'm selling this on the condition that there's no ona, that t'nai fails, in other words, there is ona, that's from the Iker Din Torah. But we're talking about the minhag that applies between the merchants, just like we saw in all sorts of other places, this idea of the minhag asochrim or the minhag atagarim, the custom of the merchants, sort of trumps the sort of Torah law. That is true here as well, even for the case of onah. And then he kind of goes further. I just want to read this last line. He says, "Al kapanim ledina be'etrog lo shayach mekach tos." So he says, "Bo ure bekona etrog echad obeys." If somebody buys one or two of throwing, "Vekadom estumim bekach bekach ve'acher sheniftachu." And once you open the boxes, "Im shav esrog harbe im arer hamocher lomar dehav mekach tos." Oh, "Im hum mekulkal she'ena shabeklum ha'ichim arer hakonel zeh." So at the end of the day, nobody quetches if they bought too good an esrog or too bad of an esrog. Go out and see what happens, you know, what the practice is. And a very similar theory is by the Pitchei Tshuva, who is another commentary who appears on the bottom of the standard Shulchan Aruch. The Pitchei Tshuva, basically what he does is he collects all the shilos and tshuvas relevant to that siman and sort of condenses them, gives you cites to them, or at least in the new volumes they bother to give you cites to them. And he says that this is a case of minhag mevatel halacha, that the custom can override the halacha, which is a line from the Yerushalmi that gets played here. What's interesting in this context is that this is a fairly aggressive. I'm sorry?
You can understand why there's no ona. But that's a
right. So the idea that minhag sort of plays in commercial. Right. But this is I think the point to make here is that this is a very aggressive.
He says afilo eino shave klum.
Right.
That's the joke.
But the minhag asochrim, we know we have a model for that in the Gemara by Sefumta. The minhag asochrim helps for kinyan.
For kinyan, okay. Yeah, but here's the jump, right? So let's just make sure everyone's with this.
It's a mitzvah of the Torah.
Right. So let's just make sure everyone's with this. So the classic case, it's called in the Gemara Situmta, and the Rishon is called minhag asochrim, minhag hatagarim, is that if there's a kinyan, so typically to make a kinyan an object, you pick it up in such a way. But let's say we sign a contract, right, which isn't a kinyan min hatorah. So the classic Gemara case is that will work, okay, and that will be effectual. That's the uncontroversial application of minhag hasochrim or minhag mevatel halacha. The more controversial one here is there's two points, one or three. One, that here we're not talking about kinyan, which you could think of as just that the Torah is just setting up default rules. Like, here's how you do it, but if you have another way, that's fine too. But we have a halacha here of onah, which is a halacha min haTorah, or of mekachtos, which is also maybe not min haTorah, maybe it's more derabanan, but clear. And, right, the idea that you need the kinyan for to be yotzi the mitzvah for the esrog, right? That in other words, this is one of the three places we actually care about the kinyan deraisa, because you have to own the esrog min haTorah to be yotzi. And even in light of all those things, he goes minhag. The other quirk here is that, in other words, you can think of minhag. Now, this statement, minhag mevata halacha, as you see, it's a very strong. I mean, just think about what it says. It's a very. Right. The Bavli doesn't have this. The Bavli talks in terms of matnao mashakatu batorah. You make a condition to sort of circumvent Torah law. But minhag mevata halacha is a much more vivid, strong. But I think it's actually needed here because even what the minhag is different. You can say a minhag is that there's some. And they had these in Europe, you know, basically up until probably the early 19th century. They had these, like, communal councils or national councils, where the Vada Arba Arts is the most famous one, that got together and said, we're making a takana. From now on, the minhag is this. So if the minhag is some is a product of some reflective, deliberative exercise, as opposed to what he means by minhag is just, right, pukhazi, go see what the market's doing. So that the market practices creates a minhag, you know, it goes from a lowercase minhag to an uppercase minhag that can now stand in contrast with the halacha itself. So that's the third shita here. Again, and that's really the Chachmat Shlomo and the Pitchei Tshuva. Okay, in the interest of time, I won't read through this last one. I mean, we'll look through it a little bit. This is a more recent personality who lived in Nutman Gestetner, who lived in Bnei Brak, who died just a few years ago, and he sort of like goes through the whole sugya, and he basically says, I guess his conclusion is that you really shouldn't buy things that are totally closed, right, that you don't have the chance to inspect for a reason stated. He says if you open it and you look at it, then it's fine. He does say, and he's quoting some other people, if it says mehudar on it, and it's not mehudar, then that's a case to rewind the transaction. You know, that's a valid, to him, that's a valid case of onah. And he even says when the price is, in other words, if this is sold as $100 esrog, right, and then you show it to people and everyone says, no, this is a $30 esrog, that would also be the case of onah. So he's willing to find, so he says, right, best not to buy it in a closed box, and that an explicit warranty or representation or an implicit one based on the price can both serve as the baseline for a claim of onah. Okay, so until this is sort of like part one or part two or most of it, where we're talking about questions of onah in, or the prices of esrogim in sort of individual spot sales. Now I want to go and sort of expand it a little more, and this is sort of a little less local and more global, this question about halachic standards and prices more generally. And the famous sort of center for this, and we're going to get back to esrogs at the end, but I want to start with the Gemara and with the Mishnah and the Gemara, is a Mishnah in Krisis. And this has to do with the intersection of how halachic standards create the price. Because obviously in a good that is bought only or mainly for to fulfill a halachic requirement, so right, the strictness or liberalness of the halachic requirement is obviously going to impact the price, right? So if all of a sudden we start being machmir on all sorts of chumras in esrogim, fewer and fewer esrogim will be deemed kosher, and by definition the price of esrogim will rise. On the other hand, if we start being megal on esrogim, then there will be more esrogim and the prices of esrogim will drop. So I think these are just fascinating sources in a variety of discussions, so it's worth seeing them here. So there is such a thing as, I guess the background for this is something called kinim. Kinim are literally birds, a nest you call them, or bird pairings, okay? And on different occasions, it's typically a woman, although it could be a man in some cases, has to bring a pair of birds, called a kain, or in multiple, kinim. Common examples are a yoledet, someone who gave birth, and a zava, whatever a zava is exactly, someone who has some sort of discharge, is also required to bring a cane. Okay, so with that background, let's look at this Mishnah in Kritut. Ha'isha sheyesh aleha safik chamisha zivot, v'safik chamisha ledot. So a woman who finds herself in the position where she is, in the case of safik, for five different sort of moments or instances of ziva, and five different births. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Josh, maybe you can enlighten us.
Talking about miscarriage.
Miscarriage, right.
Yeah, you're not sure if the miscarriage was
hits the trigger for... Right. In other words, is it late, early enough or late right. enough
early
in the process? Right, okay. So, she... I'm sorry?
I'm saying that's just an example.
Wait, this is the Mishnah. It can do this. Mevia korban echad ve'ochelet bezvachin ve'ein hashar le'achovo. So if it's a safek, she brings one, and then she's ochel bezvachim. Why that's the example chosen here is a different question, but basically that's okay, and she doesn't have to bring the rest. However, if it's vadai, right, if she has five vadai instances of ziva and five vadai instances of leda, then she brings one, and she can kind of proceed, but the rest are on credit. In other words, she owes them. No, that's the background. So it happened that in Yerushalayim, the price of each bird pairing was a dinar zav, or many dinar zav, a lot of money. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, "Hamaon hazay," sort of swore on the kedusha of the Beis Hamikdash. Lo ye'it, lo alin halayla ad sheyu bedinarin. I'm not going to go to sleep tonight until the price of kinim falls to a fraction of the amount. Nichnas leBeitin v'limed. So he entered the Beitin and he taught. Ha'isha she'eshela chamisha ledos vados. Right, the woman who has five vadai instances of leda and five vadai instances of ziva, mevi'in korba echad. In other words, he made the din of vadai like the din of safek. Right, and then the price of kinim at that day dropped tremendously. So there's lots to say here. This itself can be a whole shir or a series of them about sort of halachic consequentialism and prices and all sorts of good things. But again, this is any time you're going to talk about a question of the halachic standards and the price, this is going to be the text that's brought in. A little bit closer to home, Gemara Sukkah, and there's a parallel Gemara in Psachim, dealing with something slightly different, but the same idea. So the Mishnah, this is the Mishnah of the third parak of Sukkah, says as follows. Rabbi Shmuel says what we do, right? Three hadasim, two aravas, one lulav, one etrog. Even if two of the hadasim are chopped at the top, and one is okay. Rabbi Tarfon says, even if three of the hadasim are chopped at the top. And Rabbi Kiva says, right, no, one of each. One lulav, one hadas, one etrog, one arav. Alright, the Gemara goes, continues, and then gets to this point. Amar Rabbi Huda, Amar Shmuel, halacha ke Rabbi Tarfon. So Shmuel is reported as saying that the law is according to Rabbi Tarfon. Ve'az de Shmuel v'tamei. And the Gemara then says Shmuel follows his own reasoning. The Amar Shmuel Lahanu Dimazin the Asa. Because Shmuel issued the following warning to those who sold Hadassim. He says, Ashru Vizvinu, basically sell it for a fair price. V'ilo Darshinan Lechu Kirabi Tarfon. Because if you don't, I'm going to tell everybody that the halacha is Rabbi Tarfon. And then Gemara goes and explains that Shmuel actually really held that the halacha is Rabbi Tarfon. A parallel Gemara also with Shmuel in Psachim having to do with whether you can use clay cheres, earthenware vessels, after Pesach if it had sort of shiari chametz in there. And he says, if you raise the prices of pottery after Pesach, I'm going to tell everybody that it's mutter to use these, and therefore there's not going to be a rise on the market. Okay, so you see here, again, these are the sources anytime someone's going to discuss this kind of issue, this is in play. The Mabit, so now we're actually going to see, other than Gemara, the earliest source here. And the Mabit is someone who sort of born in Greece or Thessaloniki and then moved to Tzfat in Yerushalayim in the 16th century. And he basically takes on this practice. Well, let's read it because it's fun. So Sheila, Kana kanita b'malim et atzmam liyakir l'hosif al shaviyeh hetrogim shel mitzvah. Afilu lehidr mitzvah yoter al shlish b'mitzvah shehu siba liyakir shaviyeh hetrogim. In other words, people are bartering up the prices of esrog because they keep on saying, I only want a super nice esrog. And of course, right, once you raise the prices of the esrogim at the very top of the pyramid, right, all the esrogim rise in price. And therefore, he's basically going to go on this polemic sort of against this practice of people sort of being machmir for things that are therefore raising the prices of esrogim. And he says, I've heard of these people, even though there are many other esrogim that are perfectly fine. So what happens? In each town, everybody knows, Yanko Beryl bought the esrog there for $500, and everybody goes to his house and says, right, basically, be kona me the esrog, so I'm going to make my bracha on this esrog, and right, and therefore what they're doing is two things, or three things, this is the problem. First of all, they're therefore implicitly or explicitly saying that their esrogim are pasul, or not good, or that therefore that the only esrog that's kosher the bracha is this $500 esrog, right, which invariably raises the prices of all the esrogim. That's sort of problem one. Problem two is that he's skeptical that actually the transactions are right. Because remember, on the first
day...
Does
he say that it raises the price of all the other ones here? I didn't see that.
And in the continuation, I can send you the whole thing. He goes into this more. The other problem is, right, again, on the first day, you have to own it. So you have to, now the Gemara has a discussion, and it's a much more extensive discussion in the Rishonim about how you transfer ownership. I'll send you the whole thing. And he's skeptical of that people will go through the sort of procedural mechanics correctly, and they will actually wind up owning the esrog at the moment that they're making the bracha on. And I guess sort of in the interest of time, and then he gets into a discussion about what the issues are. Effectively, right, it has to do with this idea of a chazazit, some sort of blemish in the top third. And there's a sort of the idea out there from the Gemara, they're showing him that a chazazit in the top third of the esrog, afilu b'kol shehu, even any minute amount, is a problem. And this is, I think, to this day, the type of thing that is most likely to cause complexities in the esrog in a way that's sort of beyond the obvious. And he sort of goes on a whole discussion of how he's not quite sure that's right, and that what people are calling chazazits are not really the chazazits themselves. All right, so let's start with the paragraph that says v'tov, in the sort of last one, second to last one, page 5. Or just before, aval ein hadavar pasha b'chol ma shekoron olam chazazis avachol asurim she'ein lan pitmos, or also the pitom problem. V'tov hu leitze behen yidei chova shukane b'memono. It's much better to be yotze in an esrog that you buy with your own money. Milerdov achar ze she'ein bo echas me'elo ve'eno shelo v'tzarech shiknelo b'matana. Rather than to run after the sort of famous $500 esrog that maybe has none of these issues but isn't his and he needs someone to kind of give it to him, the matana, v'lai negomer belibo laknoso, but maybe the guy, the owner, is not really fully volitionally giving it over to him anyway, and therefore he's not yotzi the mitzvah, v'gam makonoso lehidr mitzvah lo haya lo rishus latet l'hosef al yotr mishlish b'mitzvah. Here's your line. Im husiba la'alot erech ha'acherim ha'ksherim she'eino kol kach mehudarim kamo. And even the guy who paid 500, he says it's not clear that he even has the right to pay 500 when the consequence of paying 500 is to increase the prices of all the other esrogim that are not quite as nice. And even though the Gemara in Sukkah famously talks about the case of Rabban Gamliel who paid 1,000 dinari zahav for an esrog, which is the sort of, you know, text for the whole sort of discussion about paying lots and lots of money for an esrog, and he says, and he says, no, must be that it's not that Rabban Gamliel paid such an exorbitant price just for a perfect esrog, which is the way most people understand it, but in that year esrog were very rare, and saying to get any kind of esrog you had to pay 1,000 dinari zahav, and Rabban Gamliel did this. And then he goes and he's sort of skeptical about what we mean by hagar. Okay, then the last two paragraphs. Ve'elu ha'etrogim shelanu she'anachnu regilim nefasla mishum chazazis, and our esrogim, we often reject them on the because they have this chazazis, which is this blemish in the top third, kol shehu. He says, Rubam einam nirgashim b'mishush v'gam einam ela b'nekuda achat v'afilu shekarata abua ba ena chazazis. He says these are not considered chazazis at all. He then goes to say, all right, this is the next paragraph, that chazazis, kol shehu, he says, this is fascinating, kol shehu is a relative concept. Odani omer ki afilu shehaita chazazis shehu matsui be'etrogim, even if you have this chazazis that our esrogim have, eina nikra kol shehu. It's not, now kol shehu literally means in any amount, right? So he says, that's right, it's not considered kol shehu, ela kishenir le kol adam. Unless it's sort of seen obviously to every person. Echad she'eno hadar. Ava betrogim shelanu, sherov elu she'anu karim chazazis, enem nir mayim, machmas takutam. But what we call chazazis, that most of them are not immediately observable because they're so small. Vitzarech acher she'ish lor iya zaka yoter. Again, remember, he lived in a world before glasses. So you need someone. What?
That's a good point.
I'm sorry. And you have to look at them very closely until you can see them. Right, so one person can look at, and again, a world without glasses is probably quite common. One person looks at it and it looks perfect. You need someone with 20/20 vision to be able to see a chazan. So he says, that's not called kol shehu. Basically, use your own eyesight. So maybe the answer is check your eyesight without your glasses. Right? So if to that person it's not observable, so kol shehu goes from a sort of an objective halachic category, a sort of any amount, to a subjective view based on how each person sees it. So it says it's not considered kol shehu, it's still considered hadar, even if it doesn't. So I accidentally deleted the last. In the last paragraph, he goes back to those two Gemaras, to the Gemara and the Mishnah that we cited, right? To this Gemara in Sukkah, and then to the Mishnah in Krisis, and he says, and this is the same story here, and therefore he's sort of very skeptical of this practice that is, A, raising the prices, not only raising the prices for everybody, he sort of is, almost talks about this language of motzi laz on the rest of the asrogim that everybody uses, and he redefines kosher, and he cites that Mishnah in Krisis in the Gemara in Sukkah as proof that we should sort of take a different stance to therefore increase the supply of kosher esrogim and therefore reduce the price. Okay, there's some more here. You can see maybe that the way that this mabit sort of filters into the Shulchan Aruch and impacts certainly the way the Ramah codifies the siman that has to do with paying more for an esrog because of the din of hadar. The last thing I'll just say out loud, which I thought was interesting, is another sort of choshen mishpat thing in the esrog, is when communities used to buy esrogim collectively. In other words, there's only one esrog, and there's a siman Shulchan Aruch about this, which itself tells you a lot. There's only one esrog town, and there's a whole discussion in the late Rishonim of how the money is collected. Is it by how rich you are, or is it by person? Right. So in almost every discussion of halachic tax, well, there's a question: is it per capita or is it per capital? And the same question emerges into the question of who has to pay for the esrog. And the consensus, certainly the Ramah, is that since the whole idea of the esrog is hidur mitzvah, and that's why it costs so much, so it's really by money. So therefore, only the rich people have to pay for the community to buy the esrog. Okay, so I think we saw sort of some of the different issues that arise. Again, I think this is an interesting place because you see, given what we talked about at the beginning, a couple of the sort of choshen mishpat concepts in action. I'll end with, and I put this on Facebook, so I think some of you saw, which to me is actually the best line that I heard from Rav Amital about esrogim. And he used to say, I heard him twice, say that, I'll say in Hebrew, Adam tzarich livdok ta etrog shelo be'erev sukkot. In other words, the person should check his esrog on Erev Sukkot with the same degree of diligence he checks his neshama on Erev Yom Kippur. And for most people, that means quickly and from afar. Which I think is maybe that sort of sums up the Tishrei holidays all in one. Hoshana Rabbah brings it all together, so maybe that's a good place to end. Thank you.